Today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
It's day two of our David Bowie countdown. And how are you feeling about things, Patrick?
Well, I just hope that after today, Rob Gates doesn't get too mad at us.
Okay, Patrick, so we have to pick up where we left off yesterday with our David Bowie countdown.
Yeah.
We recorded on Zoom with a bunch of listeners. You're going to hear a lot of those folks, even more so as the week continues, because people kind of loosened up, started talking some more.
Yeah, they did.
Songs. It was great. It was really fun. It was a really fun experience on Zoom, like sort of a virtual event that we did, this countdown.
It was.
The countdown was all based on listener survey. It's legit.
Yep.
It's been checked and double-checked. And
that's right.
You know, so this is what the listener said were their favorite David Bowie songs.
That's right.
If you didn't hear yesterday, go back. That was numbers 15, 14, and 13. And today you're going to hear numbers 12, 11, and 10.
All right? 10, right.
It's Rock in the Suburbs. I'm Jim Linehan.
And I'm Patrick Foster.
And let's get back to the countdown. Okay, Fame, from 1975, a number one single in the U.S. for David Bowie.
Correct. Yep.
And Patrick, I know, because we've talked about this before, especially on our old show when we did episode after David Bowie's passing, this is one of your favorites.
Love this song a lot. It's just one of those ones that you hear, and it's like instantly makes an impression on you. I mean, it's like you stepped in wet cement or something. Like, you're never going to be able to, like, it's always going to be, you know, in there on your mind. And, I'll tell you, I'd love to learn how, you know, you got into Bowie, Jim. I worked at a record store. I don't know if I ever mentioned that on this podcast, but, I'm actually going to start getting electric shocks every time I say it. But, I was like, you know, given a cool education by the older people who worked there, one of whom amazingly voted in this poll, Todd Lanier, was one of the older guys who worked at this record shop. And, I remember him, and the other guy, Jeff Burnett, saying like, here, you just start with Changes One Bowie, like get this, you know, let that soak in. And, that'll get you started. And I kind of had that. And that was kind of the one I listened to. And then, you know, like I was like a year later, then all of a sudden Modern Love came out and China Girl and all those things happened and he had this big resurgence. But that, you know, Fame on that second side, right before Golden Years, I can just remember, you know, those two, and being kind of sad because the record was almost over. There was only two songs left. But it's, you know, it's like an amazing compilation of songs. But yeah, love this. And I just, maybe I knew it, maybe I didn't, but John Lennon has a co-write credit on this song, and kind of amazing.
And it's on the track too, as well, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Yep. I love, again, somebody posted in the chat, it's another one with a great groove. It does have a great groove. I love that sort of just the dirty guitar in it, you know, yeah, the sound of it, I think is great. It does maybe goes a little too far when it gets into that fame part, but you know, I think it's an unusual number one hit song for the United States, don't you?
Yeah, mid 70s. And I'll tell you, it's way better than that Irene Cara song called Fame. I give this one the vote.
Nick Scalera, you said you have a problem evaluating the song. I'd like to hear a little bit about that.
Yeah, it was so, like, growing up as a kid in the 70s, it was on radio constantly.
Yeah.
Constantly. And it kind of exists outside of the rest of the Bowie canon for me. It just sort of sits there in this place where it was this, like, popular song. I heard it so much. I don't know to this day whether I like it or not, because it's just so ingrained, and I just can't kind of separate it from the pop music of the day. Like, I know it's Bowie. It's got the distinctive Bowie strangeness to it, but it was such a huge hit that a part of me just sort of, like, rebels against it a little bit. I can't, like, figure it out if I actually like it or not to this day.
I can relate to that. That's very interesting.
Okay. Let's go to number 11.
Didn't know what time it was, the lights were low, oh, oh. I leaned back on my radio, oh, oh. Some cat was laying down some rock and roll at a solar set. Then the loud sound that seemed to fight came back like a slow voice on a wave of faith. That weren't no DJ, that was Hazy Cosmic Time. There's a starman waiting in the sky. He'd like to come and meet us, but he thinks he'd blow our minds. There's a starman waiting in the sky.
Okay, Starman, also off the Ziggy Stardust album. And I'll just say this real quickly. And this is the first one we've gotten to that was in my top 10. That, you know how everybody, like, sort of has little things in songs, just little snippets of songs that they just love that sort of, like, give you goosebumps or, you know, chills down your spine or whatever cliche you want to use. To me, it's that guitar bit right there, that one.
Yeah.
I just, there's something about that guitar tone that is so perfect that I could just listen to it. I could just listen to that little bit and you know, maybe it should be like my alarm in the morning when I get up, you know. Like, I just, it would probably make my day a lot better. I just love, there's many things I like about that song, but that guitar bit, I love it. And it just, there's something about it.
Yeah, it's so fat and fuzzy and like glammy, and yeah, it makes you want to put on bell bottoms and just, like, kind of dance around for sure. I'll say something really quick that's essentially silly, but kind of, you know, going along with what we talked about with the covers of you know, the Nirvana cover, and all the times Bowie has been covered and, you know, appearing on the musical soundtrack, and what Nick was talking about. There's a movie called Walk Hard: The Dewey Cox Story. And late in the movie, when John C. Reilly's doing a variety show, his career is essentially bottomed out, he does Starman. And I cannot listen to this song now without seeing John C. Reilly as, you know, the late period Dewey Cox singing this. You know, I think he's even wearing a space helmet or something. It's, like, totally silly. You know, it's kind of a parody on, like, the Glenn Campbell variety show or whoever had their 70s variety shows. But, yeah, I just can't get that out of my mind of him doing Starman.
I think this song also shows, many of these songs do, but I think this is a good example, shows how well Bowie could write a chorus. It just has that hooky chorus that just, you know, pulls you right in. You know, it's just, it's so good. Bud Verge says this is your number two Bowie song.
Mm.
This is my number two. I just like the glam sound of it, and it was really reinforced when we had to go up in space a couple of years ago and rescue Matt Damon from Mars. I mean, that really kind of cemented it for me.
So is this a good time to talk about what is the fascination with outer space and David Bowie?
I think it's a product of the time. I think like 68 through like 72, 73, 74, there was the big space race. And if you notice a lot of the songs that Bowie put out at that time, a lot of them have to do with some form of space, because that's kind of where the public conscience was at. Mm. I think he's very good at being a chameleon and reading the tea leaves of the time and either, you know, embracing them or pushing them a little bit forward. And at that point, you know, everybody was, you know, worried about space and going up into the moon and space accidents and the very real possibility that somebody could be stranded in space for years and years and years and we could never get them, or we were creatures or characters up in space. That was just kind of the sign of the times during that time. You know, growing up, you know, I was probably a young kid, 5, 6, 7, 8 years old, and I remember, you know, listening to like people landing on the moon, like looking out my window, you know, in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, looking at the moon going, we went all the way up there and there's people up there right now. I mean, that's just kind of that national feeling we had back then in the very early 70s. And I think Bowie kind of captured it perfectly. He was really one of the very few that captured it that way and was actually to go like popular with it.
Without it feeling hokey.
Yes. Yeah.
Yep. And I'll say too, I have been doing recently some reading on the history of Top of the Pops, which is a BBC show. And many people cite Bowie's performance of Starman on Top of the Pops as the moment he became a star. And you can read a little bit about that. There's a whole bunch of people that went on to be music stars in Britain who recall that as like, you know, a moment that changed their lives, actually seeing him on that Top of the Pops performance when he points at the camera at the end. I'm sure you can find it on YouTube. Especially Robert Smith of The Cure basically said that was the moment, you know, that I really wanted to become, you know, a musician and a rock star. So, and he did it.
Yeah, Robert Smith. That's right. So interesting, too, because as another thing to point out about the song, too, is that double meaning, too. Starman could also be, you know, somebody who's just larger than life, right? All right, we have a couple of people with hands raised now. So this is getting exciting. People are finally getting into the groove of this, I think.
We're getting there.
Okay, let's go to John Lamoureux. We haven't heard from him.
Oh, fantastic.
Hey, John.
Hi, guys.
Hey, John.
I wanted to, first of all, I have to hold myself back from commenting on every one of these songs, every comment anyone ever makes. I just sit quietly so I don't dominate. But wanting to piggyback on what Patrick was saying, specifically from what I've heard about that performance, is there was something so provocative about him walking over to Mick Ronson and putting his arm around Mick Ronson that seems to be some kind of like flagship moment for the LGBT era or whatever, something, you know, young homosexual Britons seeing a man put his arm casually around another man, even if it's just his guitar player and they may as well be doing that back-to-back guitar thing, was so provocative, but also so comforting to a certain generation of people that they were able to, I don't know, come out or feel more comfortable or feel like they found something that spoke to them. And so anyway, that may not have been that may have been lost on us because we don't get Top of the Pops, but apparently it was a big moment for them.
Absolutely. That's a great, great point. And just to clarify, it was July 5th, 1972 when that was actually aired, or maybe the next day, right around that time.
Let's go to Stephen Routledge.
Yeah, I think John was just reading my mind there with some of his comments because he said similar to what I was going to say, but I've lost count of the amount of artists, alternative artists, who've said that seeing Bowie with his arm around Mick Ronson on Top of the Pops was like instrumental, as Patrick was saying. But I think the other context to that maybe would be lost to stateside listeners is that homosexuality was only decriminalised in 1967. Mm. So it's only a few years after that, and you got a man with his arm around another man on like the main music show in the whole country.
Wow. Yeah,
which you got to remember, back then there was only either two or three TV channels full stop. So basically, right. If you're watching telly, you're probably watching it. So yeah. It's not like only a few people see it, everyone would see it. So those two factors need to sort of, I think that amplified the impact of it even more than just the, seeing it from this end of the telescope, it looks pretty unremarkable. But obviously, I mean, I was too young at the time, but in fact, I was barely alive, but those factors add to that, to the sort of the extra context there, So.
Yeah.
Very interesting. Yep.
Okay. And, Mackenzie Crenshaw, you say that, Starman has appeal to little kids as well.
Yeah. I worked at a summer camp, and so we try to mix up what we're putting on there, so we're not listening to a bunch of garbage all summer. So we had that on there and kids love it. I mean, I think Jim might've said this earlier, but like the chorus, I think is really like the appeal to kids, and it is really fun. It is catchy. And like the idea of, a spaceman who's on the radio is like fun. So, I think that that's really the appeal, and it's easy to sing along too.
Yeah. Very, very easy. Yeah.
I want to also, thank you for that. And I want to also recognize, Tim's comment here. Tim, there's a little bit of sort of what I would call musical onomatopoeia in this song with the piano, right? So explain what you noticed there.
This is, what you were speaking about, Jim, and like, you're pulling out an instrumental portion of like one part of the song that really just kind of sticks with you. The sound of the wow, that guitar. Or, I think this song is like chock full of that sort of stuff. Like the right before the chorus kicks in, there's like a little like mini, maybe two measures of a bridge. And when it's just like da 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 da, that like piano, which always just reminded me of like a Morse code kind of signal. So it's like, or the hand claps that are part of the chorus. Like there's so many like little, pieces of music within the song to love and just kind of every time you listen to it, like here it comes. Yep. There's the hand clap. And it's just, this was in my top 10 for sure. And this is the one I'm like, all right, I got to have Starman in there. And sorry, Moon Age Daydream. I try to keep myself to like maybe one song per album. That was a kind of a rule I had when I was creating this list. But yeah, there's that little piano piece always kind of reminded me of like a Morse code message.
Yeah. Very cool. I think that's a really great observation. We're into the top 10 now, right?
Yep. I believe we're going to hit number 10.
Is my math correct on this?
Played guitar, jamming good with Webb and Gilly and the spiders from Mars. They played it left hand, but made it too far. Became the special man, then we were Ziggy's band. Ziggy really sang, screwed up eyes and screwed down hairdo. Like some cat from Japan, he could lick 'em by smiling. He could leave 'em to hang. They came on so loaded, man. Well hung in snow white tan.
All right, of course, that's Ziggy Stardust, another space alien, space-related song. But I'll just say this real quickly here. I think you could make a case that David Bowie maybe, I don't know if invented, but certainly was one of the inventors of what became alternative rock. I think this song for 1972, think about it in that context. And, you know, I was too young to you know, understand at the time. I was just a little kid, so I have no idea. But I can't imagine, like, this had sounded so weird, right? This had to have sounded so bizarre for that time. And yet it's a well-known song. It's a hit song, you know? So, there's, you know, obviously like appeal to it, but it's, when you start to really think about it, it's a very strange song to be a popular song, right?
Totally agree with that, Jim. And, you know, there's a lot to be said for the torch that Bowie carried throughout the 70s, making creative music, following his own muse while, you know, bands got bigger and played bigger and bigger arenas and got more distant from their original sound and original audiences. And these giant rock stars, you know, started to lumber across the earth, you know, the Led Zeppelins of the world, and the Stones were getting bigger and playing bigger places. And, there's a lot to be said for what he did. And, you know, this song was never a single, but it's one of those ones you just heard on the radio all the time. Like, they played it all the time on the radio. To me, it's always like, if it was Tuesday and I was listening to DC 101 and it was Two for Tuesday, this would always be the second Bowie song they chose. You know what I mean? Like, something and then Ziggy. But you heard it so much. I mean, you really did. It was, you know, at least when I was driving around in the 80s, listening to the radio, it was always on, and you knew it really, really well. And you're right. When you stop and think about it, it's really bizarre. And to think about when it was done, it's really strange. And I mean, that was the thing, you know, for me, for Bowie, he was like this person who not only mixed, you know, music, but he created characters and he played them and then kind of left them behind when he was done with them. You know, it happened over and over. And you could say his final act was maybe the greatest of all, you know, what he did there at the end. You know, it was unbelievable. But yeah, this is probably the classic example of that, you know, obviously of that character.
Yes, building. I thought this would be a good time to talk about that he not only recorded a song and an album called Ziggy Stardust, but he adopted this sort of Ziggy Stardust persona in this era as well. And again, goes back to his sensibility on how to create art beyond just what you heard on the record. You know, it was almost a performance art project in some ways, right?
And yeah, totally.
And somebody mentions here, John Wagner mentions, I think somebody else did here in the chat, about the fact that Bauhaus covered this song, and it's really an excellent cover, but I always thought it was a weird song to cover because it's so associated with the artist, right? You know what I mean? It's like you're not just covering a song, you're taking like a part of him, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
So,
yeah, totally.
Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, love to hear what the community has to say about this one.
We have a couple of people with hands raised. John, I noticed yours was up. John Lamoureux?
Yeah, I was just, I wanted to kind of tag along on your comment about him inventing alternative rock, because to me, there are three sort of pillars of modern music as we know it. I mean, if you think about pop rock music as we know it today, sort of, Patient Zero was probably Elvis.
Yeah.
Alternative rock is probably Bowie, and R&B and funk was probably James Brown. And if you think, those are probably the three great biggest pillars that make up most of, you know, 90% of popular music today. Yes, I would agree. Now, just like with the others, there are other people maybe doing things like, you know, Bowie's obviously heavily influenced by Mark Bolan. I don't know what Bowie would be without him stealing from and improving upon what Mark Bolan was doing, but it still becomes that's the big bang. That's where things sort of begin and grow and expand from there. And so anyway, I just wanted to make that comparison to other facets of pop music.
No, I totally agree. And the only reason I sort of backed off a little bit, because I was thinking also about the Velvet Underground, but the difference is the Velvet Underground did not have success at the time, the way that Bowie did, right?
Right,
right.
Over time, I think there's so many people who point to them as sort of the, you know, originators of alternative rock. But at the time, I think it was Bowie. Phil, you have a comment just about David Bowie's voice.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, we don't talk about that a lot. I mean, we talk about all these other things, but his voice has always been something to me that has attracted me. He changes voices within songs. He changes voices between eras. And this is a good example of a song where he's just like bouncing back and forth between different voices. It's like he's doing a duet with himself in some respects.
I think, yeah. And I think what's interesting there, in the same way that he would adopt personas, you know, characters sort of visually, he would sort of do that with the sound of his voice as well.
And we're going to probably hear some more of this as we go on. But I mean, some of it is actually kind of, you think he's parroting himself sometimes, you know, it's just, it's very, he just, the way he changes from, being like, a member of the smoothest singing group ever, like the Four Freshmen, and then goes into this really razor sharp voice.
Mm.
I don't know anybody who does that. And sometimes he does it in between songs.
Mm.
Yeah, that's a good observation. All right, man, this is getting good, Patrick. We have a lot of people with hands raised now.
Excellent.
They're finally getting comfortable. Maybe they got a few drinks in them, you know, perhaps. They're feeling, you know, this is a safe space. They can speak. So let's go.
Anything I say will be smarter than what Patrick says.
All right, let's go to Jason Goebel.
So I think with this song, you know, Bowie has, I loved everything Bowie did. Bowie was probably my favorite artist growing up and to date. This is Bowie's masterpiece. I mean, if you look on greatest album list, this is always consistently in the top 10. So this is like the sound, you know, I guess you would call this the lead, not necessarily the lead singer because it wasn't popular, but this is the song that sort of tells the story of Ziggy Stardust. So that's why I think this song resonates with people. Mm-hmm. I mean, that and Ronson's guitar work. But I think that has a lot to do why Ziggy Stardust is so great. I would also add, you guys had done the your mail a couple weeks ago, and you talked about Fish. This was the last album that Fish sort of covered for a Halloween. That was like an original. That was like a cover album, and you know it resonated for with them. It was always an album that they. It was always talked about that Fish was going to do this because it was a big album that sort of influenced them. And when they finally did it, it was a big deal that in the Fish community. Realize it's not about Fish, but I figured I'd throw that in.
That's a great point. Yeah.
That's very cool. Thanks, Jason. Now, let's Rob Gates. And what do you love about the song?
Oh, I loved everything about this. I mean, this was my favorite song in high school. All through, like, I mean, I love playing air guitar to it. Like, this is like the quintessential air guitar song. It was one you could, as it says on the album, play at maximum volume and just, you know, scream it, you know, sing along with it. I just loved it. Everything about the riff. It's got that great riff.
Yeah.
There's so much to love about this song and its placement on the album. How it ties everything before together on the album. Mm. You know, as Jason just said, I mean, it tells the whole story.
Okay, so what you heard there, we left off with Ziggy Stardust at number 10.
Mm-hmm.
I will just tell people that listener Rob Gates was not happy, even though it was in the top 10. He was not that it was not at least in the top 3. And even after the event, he was still texting me about that. He wanted a recount. And, and I'm not even kidding about that. He was like, send me the raw data. I need to see this. So
his disgruntlement continued throughout the week as well. So
that's right.
So, I love a man who believes in something.
Absolutely. It's great. Absolutely. Yep. It was his passion is endearing. Okay.
Comes through.
All right. Now we're into the top 10 and we will pick that up, starting with number 9 tomorrow. All right.
Mm-hmm. Sounds good.
All right, let's get out of here. It's Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Linehan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
We'll talk to you all tomorrow. Yeah, now this is interesting. Patrick is in charge of all the tabulations, so he sees all of your choices.
Ballots.
So I don't know any of this stuff, right? So he has a different insight into our audience than I do.
Yeah, and be happy to share those ballots.
He actually thinks of you as individuals, where I just think of you as a mass, right?
The audience. Okay.